Saeed because I was a friend of his and for a very, very long time. And,
Oh, that's great. So you know him. So you guys know each other.
Yeah, I've known him for a very, very long time. And of course, he died a couple weeks ago. Prematurely and very severe blow. We, those of us who knew him, were aware of the fact that he was a dying man. He'd been doing it for the last 10 years that had some kind of blood leukemia type cancer and had been on chemotherapy for, I don't know, 10, 12 years.
Jeez.
And it was very severe. The treatments were very, very severe, but it didn't prevent him from writing, from going all over the world, giving lectures and so on and so forth. Incredibly amazing devotion to the best word that I can use to talk about Bedard Saeed is justice. Mm-hmm. So when I get the call from my former student, Paul Bouvet, who was also very close to Edwin, saying that he had died, I that just was a terrific blow to me, and I sort of been hung up on it ever since. Anyway, in my mind, Edwin Saeed is probably, or was probably, the most important and most intelligent, most erudite critic of this generation, if not previous generations. Just an amazing intelligence and, I should say, also that I was visiting Paul Bouvet, this was a couple of years ago, in Pittsburgh, and we were listening to Glenn Gould. You know Glenn Gould, the music at all?
Mm-hmm,
Glenn Gould, a video of Glenn Gould playing the Bach-Goldberg variation. And it was just, I had never seen Glenn Gould perform. I'd heard him playing piano on tapes and CDs, but I never heard him perform. I never saw him perform. And the experience was just, to me, mind-blowing. The intensity with which he played, and the dexterity, and but something more was happening as we were listening to him, watching him. And he would hum as he played. You'd probably get hear that in some of his tapes, especially when he's playing Bach. He would hum, and it was a kind of it just totally gave. But there was something about it that about his playing that was absolutely undefinable, and yet we both felt that it was more important than even his. The quality of his playing was something else. We didn't know exactly what it was. And after the performance, we started talking about it. And in both of our responses, this something other emerged, and we were trying to decide what that something other was. And who that we knew or had read or listened to that had that same quality. Well, the word we came up with was grace. And we had a hard time deciding who, coming up with people who had grace, who had the gift of grace. But a couple of names came up. One was Henry Adams. Another one was Thomas Pynchon. And another was Edward Said. And in the process of talking about it, we never really arrived at any definition of grace, and I think that's precisely the point. It's something that is absolutely unspeakable. But you know when someone is gifted with grace, you know it. At least that's the way I feel. Anyway, when I left, I was so absolutely taken over by this notion of grace, the image of Glenn Gould playing the Goldberg Variations, that it just took me over, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. So I decided what I'd do was to attempt to answer the question, what is grace, by way of just listening to a lot of music, thinking of the music in terms of Glenn Gould's playing the Goldberg Variations. And I started to put together a CD in which I would record. This is over a period. This took over like 6 or 7 months. It was not something that I just thought do it. I listened to a lot of music in the process of reading, thinking back, and all. And I put together this first CD in which contained music and a series of exchanges, email exchanges I had with Paul Bouvet. And this process turned out to involve like four of them. I did four CDs over a period of about 5 or 6 months. And finally, I just had to give up because I had not arrived at any definition of grace. But I could have gone on forever. But again, that's the point. But one of the things that occurred to me, one way of defining grace without defining it is, and this is the conclusion, the fourth CD, was to say that, I don't know what grace is, but I know what it's not.
Kid Rock.
I named what it's not in the last verbal part of it. Anyway, the point is that the presence running all the way through those four CDs, they're like 55 minutes each, so a long stretch. I've been trying to get people to listen to these, and so far I've sent these out to like maybe 10 or 12 people, and so far I've had only a couple who have really listened all the way through.
I would like to listen to them. I mean, I really would. I mean, do you have a lot of Glenn Gould?
Because I've seen videos of him play, too.
Sorry?
I've seen videos of Glenn Gould in one of my music class, an undergraduate.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just intense.
Yeah.
So, Leonard Cohen?
Sorry?
Leonard Cohen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great.
Well,
I
have to say that I don't know about Leonard Cohen, but I didn't include Heidegger, who to me has been my teacher. I didn't include him. I don't think that Heidegger had grace. So, on the other hand, Marvin Gaye had grace.
Yeah.
Especially the latter Marvin Gaye.
I'm just curious. I mean, this is kind of a personal question. You don't have to answer it, but I'm just wondering, throughout your academic career, have you ever taken flack from any of your colleagues because of your interest in Heidegger? Because he can be controversial.
Well, let me put it this way, my book on Heidegger has been the topic of a considerable amount of criticism, precisely because of the very easy way that were the victims, let's say, of Heidegger's critique of the ontotheological tradition, especially the humanist aspect of the ontotheological tradition, how easy it has been for them to identify what Heidegger said with totalitarian, with Nazism. And there have been a number of essays and references to my apology, as it's put, for Heidegger's Nazism. I think that's... Well, let me put it this way, that because of that, Heidegger has been... interdicted. No one reads Heidegger anymore. Not even people who have been tremendously influenced by him read him anymore, because it's a tacit admission that the person who reads him with any kind of sympathy is automatically a Nazi or a totalitarian.
That term is used a lot. I mean, I was in the history. I've been in my career at this university. I've been in the German department, which used to exist. I've been in the history department and another department. And I mean, that word is used to label anyone that has an opinion different than the consensus. I mean, that word's tossed around a lot. You're a Nazi. You're not. I mean, I tried years ago to get a Germanic studies program at this university, and I worked with Larry Wells. I don't know if you knew Larry Wells, a friend of mine. He's dead now. I helped him and his wife remodel a room one time in their house on Vernon Drive. But, because I tried to get this certificate program started, I was called a Nazi. And I went through the Innovational Projects Board, and they denied it. It's a term that crops up. If you just vary from the consensus, you're a Nazi.
Okay, anyway...
Who else was on the CD? I'm really curious.
Yeah. Can we hear a little excerpt of that?
I'm just curious who else you had on it. That's all.
Child Lines had grace.
Are they all musical?
Herman Melville had grace.
Oh, was that Charles Dickens?
No.
Virginia.
No. sorry.
She wasn't. Oh. She wasn't. She didn't partake of those four CDs. She was Jerry.
Charlie Parker.
Well, my point is that I think that the presence in all on all of those CDs, those 4 hours, was Edward Said, and that's the point that I wanted to make. He has grace, and of course the irony is that there's always been, since he wrote Orientalism, that great book that transformed literary studies in America, has been the object of tremendous vilification and misrepresentation. And that culminates in the most contemptible way after his death, where a campaign has been mounted in order to minimize the influence that he's had on contemporary intellectual life, especially in the universities. In fact, just about 4 or 5 days ago, someone, a former student of mine, mailed me a website that involved hearings that are taking place in the House of Representatives right now, in which the members of the committee, I forget the name of the committee, have been soliciting witnesses to come to talk about higher education in the United States, with a focus primarily on post-colonial studies, which they are interpreting as being anti-American. And constituting a great threat against the homeland security. And a couple of the witnesses who are professors in American universities have invoked Edward Said as being the originator and founder and the spokesman behind this whole takeover of literary studies in America by post-colonialists whose whole object is to undermine the patriotic orientation of American students. And as far as I could tell from the witnesses, no one has been asked by the committee who has any sympathy with Edward Said or with the post-colonial studies that his work so implicitly inaugurated. The object of this committee is to create a department of an institution within one of the cabinets to monitor, to oversee what's happening in the humanities courses in American colleges, which is pretty frightening.
McCarthy?
Well, you know, the federal government, I'll tell you a personal experience I just had. The federal government is playing those kind of games with everybody, and they're using the purse strings to do it. The Veterans Administration owed me a substantial amount of money, and they wouldn't give it to me. They just kept sending me letters saying, you know, we're processing, we're looking at it, blah, blah, blah. 9 months went by, and they were still sending me these letters. I contacted Maurice Hinchey, the congressman. 3 weeks later, I had the check in my mailbox. But they're stalling because all the money's going to Iraq. My doctor told me he can't collect payments on his Medicare patients, which are elderly Social Security recipients. The government's stalling on the payments because they're sending all the money to Iraq. So they're playing all these games with everybody.
Yeah. Well, it's in, I think this is a context in which you know, reading Culture and Imperialism ought to emerge from. And of course, any person who really reads Edward Said will immediately understand that that his orientation towards the conditions of the contemporary moment, the global conditions of the contemporary moment, is nothing to do with vilifying certain constituencies in the modern world. His primary focus is on, as I, the word that I used before, is justice. And this is one reason why culture and imperialism is in many ways more reflective of Edward's orientation towards the conditions of modernity than Orientalism. But I want to talk a little bit about Orientalism because I don't think that the full scope of what Said is saying in culturalism and culture and imperialism can come through without realizing both its continuity and its departure from his book, Orientalism.
I was wondering if you knew that website you were talking about offhand. Could that be something to...
I don't have it with me, but so I'll bring it when I come.
Okay. Is it the House of Representatives?
House of Representatives. I think that this momentum is being investigated by both the Senate and the House of Representatives. I think both of them are dealing with this issue, the anti Americanism that is emerging, that has taken hold in colleges and universities, primarily by way of the introduction of post-colonial studies.
What I see happening with that is that the government will play with the purse strings. I mean, a lot of universities do research for the military and for the government. They'll probably just withhold money from schools that advocate that, is my guess. And this university in particular has changed over the years. You know,
well, I mean, this is an initiative that has been going on for a long time. That organization, that institution, federal government institution that was first headed by, well, when it became headed by William Bennett, the very right-wing director of, he was the director of
education.
He was director of education, but before that, he was the director of the, I forget what that organization, the federal agency which dispensed money to scholars in the area of the humanistic studies. The National Endowment for Humanities, that's it. When he became, and then it was after he left to become the director of drug control, the position was given to Lynn Cheney, the wife of now Vice President of the United States, who has crusaded against the whole momentum of post-structuralist studies. She took a PhD in English in, I don't know, the University of Utah or somewhere. And she has been literally on a crusade against post-structuralist thinking, against deconstruction, in the name precisely of the assumption that education should generate patriotic citizens of the United States. And the first thing that Bennett did, and this was followed up, I don't know what the situation now, I don't even know who the director of the National Endowment for Humanities is, but a momentum was developed, was inaugurated by Bennett, which involved the very careful discrimination as to who gets money from the National Endowment for Humanities to do research. And it's become very obvious that anyone who does the kind of work, even remotely, that Edward Said does, doesn't get funded. The people who apply now, to the point where people like me or like Edward or his students simply don't apply anymore, because it would be just a waste of time. So this momentum has been going on for a very long time. The alarming part about it is, of course, that it is now, as I've just tried to suggest, that it is now being debated in Congress as to whether or not to establish a board to monitor, to oversee, you know, what people do, what professors and what students are doing in literature departments. That's the alarming thing. That is to say, there's a kind of certainty about this effort to identify literary studies, cultural studies, with the notion that they are at the present time aiding and abetting terrorism. Mm-hmm. That therefore, in other words, that the intrusion, the intervention of the American government into higher education has to do with the assuring of homeland security and the identifying of anyone who speaks is critical of American foreign policy is identifiable with aiding and abetting terrorism. This is what the alarming thing is.
It's neo-McCarthyism. No.
Sorry?
It's neo-McCarthyism.
Mm-hmm. William Bennett's been discredited now. He wrote a book called, I think, The Book of Morals or something along that line. I never read it, but he went out to Las Vegas and he got drunk and he groped a woman in the casino.
No,
and he ended up
governor.
He lost something like $100,000 or $200,000 gambling. So he's been discredited, just like Rush Limbaugh and these other guys. I mean,
he has been discredited. Anyway, let's come back to Edward. I want to say a little bit about Orientalism by way of providing the context for the continuity with Orientalism, but also a modification of his perspective on Orientalism. Orientalism was written, published in 1978, I think it was, and what he does literally, virtually for the first time in the context of humanistic studies is to examine texts written by Westerners, Europeans who represent the Orient. And the point that he's attempting to make by way of this examination of texts that deal with a Western text that deal with the Orient is that these texts, whether they involve travel, travelogues, novels, autobiographical accounts of Westerners in the Orient, these texts, which have as their fundamental purpose to provide knowledge about the Orient, are written from a deeply inscribed Western perspective, and which represents the Orient, that is to say, in terms of the value system of a people of the West, which itself has defined its understanding of Western civilization of the West by way of its relationship to the Orient, that is to say, in terms of what it is not, what the Orient is what the West is not. And then he proceeds from there to indicate that with the emergence of the study of the Orient, the literal scholarship about the Orient, the emergence, that is to say, of area studies in the West, scholars who deal with issues of languages, culture, anthropology, and so on and so forth, in the name of objectivity, have nevertheless been deeply informed by the representation of the West that has emerged slowly but surely and in a fundamental way from the time of the Greek-Persian Wars, so that the Orient is invariably put, even by objective scientific accounts, and many of his a number of his chapters are on precisely the great intellectuals who have written about the Orient, Ernest Renan, Louis Massignon, and Englishman, Saeed mentions him. Lane, yeah.
EW.
I think it's Edward Lane. Anyway, that these objective scholars who have given us our understanding of the Orient, given the West its understanding of the Orient, have given us an Orient which has fundamentally nothing to do with the realities of Orientals, that has only to do with the Orient as it is necessary for the West to represent it in terms of this binary opposition between West and East. And in the process of analyzing these texts, both amateur texts, travelogues, so on and so forth, and the scholarship, he makes a tremendously powerful case for identifying this cultural production of the Orient with, of course, the political conquest of the Orient. That these cultural texts go hand in hand with and support the aggression of Western civilization against the Orient, virtually from the very beginning, but increasingly and most important, of course, from the moment of the establishment of the study of Orientalism. So Orientalism, in other words, has nothing to do, the discourse of Orientalism has nothing to do with the Oriental people. It has to do primarily with the West's representation of the Orient, and that representation always has to be such that it renders and proves and legitimates the West's understanding of the Orient as inferior to the West, in terms, that is to say, of that binary opposition between between the West and the Orient. That book, as I said, had an enormous impact on cultural studies, but there was also severe criticism of Said's book, The Orient, by even sympathetic scholars and critics, insofar as the whole discourse on the Orient by Edward Said said very little about the realities of the Oriental people themselves. The whole orientation of Said towards this question of the relationship between the West and the East was focused primarily on the West representation of the Orient, not on the actualities of the Orient that these Western interpretations had annulled and minimized. And this is the point of departure for culture and imperialism. Although he doesn't apologize for what he did, represented Western Orientalism, simply because that was not his project. His project was not to tell us what he thought the truth of the Oriental world, especially the Islamic world, was. His object was to show that the truth discourse about the Orient coming out of the West was a was a fabrication which had a political and global ideology behind it, which enabled and justified the aggressive practice of the Orient, of the West vis-a-vis the Orient. So this book, Culture and Imperialism, will now speak to the question of how the Orient itself responded, reacted to the aggressive incursions or interventions of the West on the Orient. And the fundamental point that he's making in culture and imperialism is that we must understand the question of the relationship between the West and the other world, in this case the Orient, but he also said it has to be done with Africa, with South America, it doesn't matter, anything really outside of the Western value system, that we must read these texts, and this term comes not accidentally from music, and not accidentally from the music that was a characteristic of the moment that Bach was writing, contrapuntally. That's a very important word for Edward Said's discourse, we would say, contrapuntally. In such a way, in other words, that the discourse of the Orientalism, the discourse, that is to say, of the West on Orientalism, has to be read simultaneously with the discourse of the Orient coming out of the minds and hearts of the Oriental people. And texts therefore and this generates a kind of mutual a deconstruction of each other's discourses. I think that's basically what he means by Orientalism, and I would go so far as to say that another term for this is a term that I've used in this course, an Auseinandersetzung, a antagonistic but intimate engagement of points of view understood simultaneously and in a kind of unending and uninterruptible way. But now let me, I think I've talked about this earlier, but I want to repeat it if I already have, because I think it's important to understand this whole momentum that Said had a great deal to do with inaugurating and making a significant place for it in academia. I think it's important to look back at how someone like Edward Said was enabled. Why, for example, didn't an Edward Said emerge 175, 100 years ago? Why an Edward Said emerges only in the 1970s? The question of, from perspective of the tremendous impact of Said's Orientalism, the kind of influence he's had on the Academy, we forget to ask that question. How did it happen? Why didn't it? Why wasn't this a? This is so obvious. We might say it's now so obvious. Why didn't it happen earlier? I'm not asking that as a question.
Oh, because I have an answer, but
well, hold your answer for a while until I try to establish the momentum and pick up on it. Moment when asked that question, a couple of things emerge. One, it tells you how fundamental, how deeply backgrounded this binary opposition, this binary logic, which is so fundamental to Western civilization, which in this context means the binary opposition between the West and the East, but which involves a whole relay, a whole chain of oppositions that goes back to the founding opposition, which is to say the opposition between the notion of identity as opposed to the notion of difference, that ontological opposition which constitutes the very founding of the idea of Europe, the idea of the West, the emergence of metaphysical thinking. Said, of course, resists this. This is one of the things that one of the great the aspects of contention. Whenever I had the opportunity to talk with Edward Said, he kept saying to me, you know, I really like what you do, Bill, but I'm very troubled by your invocation of those early post-structuralists. I'm really troubled by your obsession with Heidegger's destruction of the ontotheological tradition, that ontological. You can make your work more influential if you focused on the social and the political aspects of this thing. I simply would respond and to say to him that, you know, whether you realize it or not, Edward, you are being part of your discourse is an ontological discourse. Part of your fundamental part of your orientation is a critique of Western metaphysics. It's simply that you're not avowing it. You're not wasting your time articulating that because you have more immediate social and political concerns. One. It's there. In the ontological is there. Two, much more immediately than the ontological is the tremendous influence of Michel Foucault on his book Orientalism, and even in Culture and Imperialism, although you remember that on a couple of occasions in Culture and Imperialism, he is very critical of Foucault because Foucault, according to Said, remains his topic, his area of concern is the West, and it disturbs Edward that Edward Said that Foucault had very little to say about the relationship between the West and the Orient. I'll come back to this as we go along. So what I'm saying is that Edward Said emerges as a critic of Western imperialism, Western Orientalism, Western imperialism, at a moment when something has happened to literary studies, something has happened to, in the context of information dissemination, knowledge production, that was crucial, that was absolutely essential before he could do what he does in Orientalism and in culture and imperialism, or in his book about Palestine and so on and so forth, or in his book on the media representation of Islam and so on and so forth. And that was, and this is where we come back to that, something that I said very early on, and that is the breakdown, the collapsing, by way, I believe, post-structuralist thinking of the base superstructure model, which was the model for oppositional criticism up until this point, or up until the post-structuralist revolution. Base superstructure model. This is a broadly speaking Marxist. Marxism, of course, was the oppositional discourse from the time of the October Revolution up until this moment. And its orientation, its oppositional orientation towards Western civilization was basically in terms of the West's having become manifestly capitalist. And so this is not necessarily true of Marx himself, but it becomes true of Marxism when, at a certain moment in the Marxist tradition, and that's quite early on, the much more ambiguous, much more fluid, much more even contradictory interpretation or representation of the base that Marx had, Marx's representation of the base was transformed into Marxism. That is to say, when the fluid, ambiguous or ambivalent understanding of the base on the part of Marx and Engels in their writing was restricted to the means of production. That is to say, when the base came to be interpreted reduced and interpreted to being economics, the economical. And at this point, when this happened, when the basis come to be understood by Marxism as being the involving the economic, the site of economics, then it understood all the other aspects of social and political life as superstructural or epiphenomenal. They didn't count. They were absolutely, they counted, but they were absolutely determined by the economic base. So instead of looking at, and what were some of these? Family, the notion of the family, religion, churches, cultural production, politics and political parties. I should put here the media. These are all superstructural from the perspective of Marxism. Although, as I say, and I want to emphasize, Marx was a lot less uncertain about what constituted the base in his writing. Didn't matter at all, unfortunately. It came sort of immediately to be interpreted by the identified with the ownership of the means of production as the economy today. And this was the mode of oppositional criticism up until post-structuralism. Post-structuralism, broadly speaking, post-structuralism collapsed this base superstructure model. They understood it as, you might infer, they understood it as being a profoundly metaphysical orientation towards the question of the social organization, social and political organization of existence. So that the post-structuralist critique is a critique of the understanding of the base as, you know, something that could be something that was absolutely fixed and determinative. Fixed and determinative. It was the beginning and end of everything else. And insofar as post-structuralism constitutes a critique of any notion of identity, any notion of a fixed center of a logos, of a principle of presence, the implications for the base superstructure model was to dismantle the fixity of this base, the identity that informs this base that was made so fundamental to Stalinist communism. And this critique of the principle of identity, the principle of presence, the principle of the notion of a fixed center, and so on and so forth, had a profound influence on Marxists. And the consequence of this influence on Marxism or post-structuralism was the formation of a group of critics that came to be called neo-Marxists. So the day superstructure collapses. The other thing too, by the way, is that that these various sites on this, in this base superstructure model, the Marxist hierarchies as well, beginning with looking at the subject, family, religion. I think he just about this in this order: religion, cultural production, including the media and the political parties, political governments, and so on and so on and so forth. And so that an aspect of this Marxist interpretation of the base superstructure model also involved disciplines, the disciplining of these various sites, so that if a Marxist studied the notion of the family, the bourgeois family, what mattered was purely the study of the family without reference to religion or culture or the media or the notion of the subject. The study of the family, independent of these, but dependent only on the economic base. Only on the economic base. And this post-structuralist momentum, this momentum that precipitated a neo-Marxist orientation towards social formations, collapsed this base superstructure so that it looks like this, the ontological all the way across to the, say, the imperial domain, the global imperial domain. And with the collapse of this structure, what becomes very crucial is the cultural. Let me put it this way. The reason Marx and Engels and following them, the Stalinists, overdetermined the economic base is because in the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, the emergence of capitalism, was so fundamental and so all-encompassing and so new that Marx and Engels, to a certain degree, but the followers of Marx and Engels, the Marxists, thought that this was, understood this over-determination of the economic site by way of the emergence in the 19th century of the industry and the question of class, the question of the proletariat, and so on and so forth. That was so prominent in a way that it had never been before that Marx and especially the Marxists thought that this was something fundamental to being. That the economic base was fundamental to being. Whereas in reality, I'm reading this from a post-structuralist or neo-Marxist perspective, whereas in reality, it was simply an over-determination of the site of the economics, an over-determination. That is to say, it was prominent. The age, the more historical moment, made it prominent. They all became aware, everyone became aware of the tremendous importance of the economic site by way of the tremendous transformation of society, Western societies, by the Industrial Revolution, by the rise of technology, and above all, of course, by the visibility of the oppression of the system of those people that fed this machinery, which the Marxists call the proletariat. But after the the triumph, the emergence of in the capital, the emergence of the economic base. The rise also of information, of the dissemination of knowledge, began to minimize of the consciousness of Westerners of the importance of the economic base. And at a certain moment, quite recently, i.e. about the time of the 1960s, all of a sudden the what was overdetermined in the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century becomes minimized in favor of the emergence of our information retrieval, i.e. the world that we're living in now, which has, in a phenomenal way, has overdetermined information. The media, electronic highways, which has become global, the very thing that Negri and Hart talk about. So this becomes primary. So this is the whole raison d'etre for Negri and Hart's analysis of the global moment. They go so far as to say that the new proletariat is not simply the proletariat of the 19th century as it was represented by Marx and early Marxism. The new proletariat includes the laborer in factories, but that's not as important as the proletariat that now is identifiable with those who operate the electronic media, what he calls the intellectual proletariat, and it's precisely this collapsing of the base superstructure historically and from the perspective of post-structuralist criticism and new Marxist criticism, the collapsing of this virtually on its own has had as one of its consequences the realization that the economic base, which was taken to be as an ontological principle, was simply the precipitation at a certain moment in history of a certain aspect or a certain dimension of being, of social being, that had no fundamental ground in being itself, was not natural, in other words, but simply a construction that was precipitated by history, by human beings at a certain moment in history. And so the whole notion of a base, a fixed base, no longer has validity. Separation of the various sites on this continuum between base and superstructure, neither does the hierarchization of these have any fixed and absolutely grounded validity. That, in other words, two things happen. One, with the with the neo-Marxist momentum and the rise of cultural production, broadly speaking, over-determination of cultural production after the waning of the industrial moment. And that is, one, the collapsing, and two, the recognition that all these sites are absolutely integral and indissolubly related. That when you're talking about a cultural site, say, the novel, you don't deal with the novel, you don't think the novel independently of all these other sites. They all are interrelated. Yes, you're going, as we are doing now, as Negrin Hart does, for example, or Grenning does, since information retrieval has been overdetermined, history is overdetermined, we attend to that primarily. We give it a kind of priority. But we don't give it the kind of priority that any one of these sites was given prior to this moment, because we see this overdetermination in relationship to all the others, to the economic, to the notion of the subject, to the notion of the family, to the notion of religion, to the notion of the media, the notion of culture, and so on and so on and so forth. They're interrelated. They're indissolubly related. And it's for this reason that in the 1960s, with the awareness of the decline of industry, 19th century understanding of capitalism. With the decline of that and the emergence and overdetermination of information retrieval, the focus shifted away from economic interpretations of social formation and the idea that all of these other superstructural sites were simply determined in an absolute way by the base superstructure. Now we attend to the culture because it's been overdetermined in this historical moment. But then we do this, as I said, with as much awareness as possible of it, of the culture's relationship to the economic base, to the notion of family, to the notion of the media, and so on and so forth. So that when we're reading a novel, we overdetermine the novel, we read the novel, we read it not the way it was read by the new critics. Or not one. The new critics read the novel as autonomous. That's to say, having no connection whatsoever value system of the author, and no connection to the historical context out of which it emerged. The new critics read a literary text, poem, novel, as if it were autonomous, autotelling, self-referential. One. And the Marxists, of course, read the novel in the grotesquely reduced way that identified the novel as simply an expression of you read the novel if you read the novel at all as a Marxist, you read it from the point of view of what it could tell you about what really counts, as I say, the economic base. With this revolution that is precipitated by the overdetermination of culture, you read a novel now the way Edward Said reads a novel, where he says that and the term that he uses is two things: about Edward, about Edward's orientation. He calls his kind of criticism secular criticism. He underscores that. It's a tremendously important term. Or, alternatively, he calls it worldly criticism. He underscores it. Secular. What does he mean by that? Broadly, it means the text works in history. The text is absolutely and indissolubly in a relationship with history. The text is a worldly text, as opposed to the new critics who thought the text was autonomous. It was its own world, had nothing to do with the world, with historicity. But he also means, besides that, as the word secular would suggest, that it is not informed by some transcendental principle. By secular, he does not simply mean this is anti-religious, or the antithesis of anti-religious. What he means by secular is that the text should not be understood as as if it were determined by some transcendental principle, whether that principle is God and its church, or any other form of metaphysical thinking. Any other form of metaphysical thinking. Any other understanding of being which is informed by a principle, a fixed and a universal principle of presence. Those systems of those understandings of being and the system of reading that they apply are the antithesis of secular. What they do is to take the text outside the context of the dynamics the differential dynamics of historicity. It's in this sense that he means texts are worldly, and criticism should be secular. Let me put it another way, that means, therefore, you can't read a text, or if you do read a text from the perspective of some transcendental principle, whether it's God or some religious orientation, or from a Hegelian, or from a causal instrumentalist perspective, which have their point of departure in something outside the world. They have their point of departure in some principle of identity. And it's precisely this whole transformation that occurs with the emergence of overdetermination of, broadly speaking, culture, that Edward Said, like few people, few intellectuals in the West, enabled him to come at the question of critique from a perspective that was not locked in to a metaphysical perspective, as was Marxism. There's a close, I think, in fact, early on,